One key to limiting climate change is carbon dioxide removal. That's according to a new international report that finds that removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere will be a key part of hitting international goals aimed at lowering the overall amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. The report sums up the current state of carbon dioxide removal and how much more will be needed. According to the report, we need a big boost in CO2 removal technologies alongside efforts to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. The La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison was involved in the State of Carbon Dioxide Removal Report. Our guest is one of the report's authors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere? Do you think that there should be a bigger focus on this, more public investment in developing and implementing new technologies that help take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Gregory Nemeth is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs and a contributor to the State of Carbon Dioxide Removal Report. Gregory, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks. It's good to be back.
We talk a lot on this network and elsewhere about cutting carbon dioxide emissions to help stop or at least slow down climate change. Can you talk about the importance of focusing on removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as well?
Yeah, sure. The first thing I'd say is that removing CO2 from the atmosphere is not a substitute for reducing emissions. We need to do both. We need to cut emissions rapidly to avoid the worst damages of climate change that happen once we exceed 1.5 and 2 degrees, and we're already at 1.2. So it's not a substitute, but because we've dithered for 30 years in reducing emissions, we have a bigger challenge on our hands than we would have had if we had started seriously 30 years ago. And so now we do actually have to do some work to remove some of the CO2 that's already there. On the order of maybe 10 to 20% of what we do for emissions reductions, we have to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and move it in the other direction.
This report sums up global efforts at carbon dioxide removal. I see a number of 2 billion tons of carbon dioxide taken out of the atmosphere per year, I think it was. But it sounds like a big number, but I gather it's not big enough.
Yeah, everything's big when you're talking about the climate. It's the whole planet we're talking about here. But just to put it in perspective, yeah, we're already doing 2 billion tons of removal, mostly through trees and planting forests and that type of thing that we're all familiar with. We put 40 billion tons into the atmosphere every year. So we've got two going the other direction. So it's helpful. It's a good start, but we need to get up to like 10 billion tons of removal in the next 30 years to make this relevant to the climate.
I see lots of things about these high-tech options for taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. As you just mentioned, though, high technology like trees, and I gather soil management, is doing a lot of the job. How important is that? Are we actually adding to the number of trees that's taken out, or are we just like coasting in our current level of forests right now?
Yeah, no, right now, I mean, this, like you said, it's a global report. So for the whole world, we are removing 2 billion tons a year through trees and other land management practices. So that's in the right direction. We probably need to scale that up by a factor of 2, so double it to maybe 4 gigatons. But at some point, we start to have impacts on using land for other things like agriculture. And so we can't do it all with things like trees. So we do need to go to engineered solutions as well. But one of the options that seems especially intriguing is storing carbon in soils, because there you have this co-benefit of higher carbon in soils. In some situations, can actually increase agricultural yields, and the total amount of available capacity to store carbon in soils is gigaton scale. And so that's a pretty promising direction to move as well.
We're talking about a new global report on the state of carbon dioxide removal, looking at efforts to get this key climate change atmospheric substance out of the atmosphere. Gregory Nemeth is with us, a co-author of that report, professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're curious about the options for getting the CO2 out of the atmosphere once it's already there, 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Gregory, before we dig into some of the technologies that may be options, you were one of the lead authors on a chapter of the report looking at a global investment in these technologies. What are we seeing?
Yeah, so we're seeing some promising signs. We're seeing Lots of patenting in this area. So that's usually a leading indicator of innovation and of technologies to emerge in the future. In particular, we're seeing patenting in what's called direct air capture. So that's basically doing on a large scale what we already do in submarines and spacecraft, where we're removing people's breath that's exhaling CO2. So we know how to do that. But the challenge is to do that at a really large scale when we're taking it out of the atmosphere. So we are seeing some promising signs of innovation. We're also seeing signs of investment in research and development expenditure. We tracked about $4 billion worldwide. To put it in perspective, about $17 billion was spent last year in research and development on clean energy technology. So it's still not as big as that, but it's going in the right direction. The U.S. is playing a pretty big role in that amount. So there are some promising signs, but the scale-up challenge is really gigantic. And so that's the next stage we have to deal with.
Right. If we're talking about boosting our investments in research and development this year, it could take a long time to develop those things, scale them, and then put them into practice at a large scale. Are these things that are going to happen soon enough to make a difference?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly the issue. Can we do it fast enough? And there's urgency here. And we know from previous technologies that it takes a while. It takes a while to go from patent to laboratory to development stage to actually scaling up to something that's big. So in a way, we know from the past that this is not a simple challenge. It's not something we can do overnight. But we also know from the past is that we've done this successfully in other technologies, and some of them that are relevant to the climate, like what we've seen with wind and solar in the last 20 years. A lot of that's been inspiration for us who've been working in that area to say, well, could carbon removal kind of be where renewables were 25 years ago? Interesting, promising, clean, but too tiny to actually do anything for the energy or climate issue. But they grew, and they grew at like 30% a year. And when you do that over 30 years, you start to become a substantial part of the solution. And so the question is, could carbon removal technologies have that kind of trajectory? Because if they take that trajectory of what solar has done and grow at 30% a year, they don't even need to go as fast as electric vehicles, which have grown even faster than that. But if we do have that type of investment and growth, then we are talking about billions of ton of removal of these novel technologies for carbon dioxide removal. So a lot of what we're doing is comparing it to things that we've done well, and then looking at, well, how did we do those things? What did we do for, say, ammonia synthesis? So making fertilizer a worldwide global commodity from something that was tiny 100 years ago, that took a long time, but it also took lots of investment. And that's a pretty good model from what we might need for carbon removal as well.
There are different technologies out there when it comes to carbon removal, some of them outlined in the report. Is there one that stands out to you as closest to the starting gate, if not already running?
Yeah, so the one that's closest to the starting gate and already running are planting trees, no question about that. And the only issues that come up with planting trees are, one, how durable is that for storing carbon? Like, could you decide to cut down the trees with deforestation, or could you have wildfires that take them away, or would you start using agricultural land for forest? So we do have concerns, but that's a technology that's proven, and no issues about how does it work and does it work. On the other hand, we have technologies that don't have those same land use issues and substitution issues. For example, doing this submarines technology called direct air capture, which doesn't take much land, and it's a chemical process. And, you know, there the issue is it takes energy to heat up the solvents to remove the CO2, and it takes capital to build all these machines. And so there's different challenges for these different technologies. But one of the reasons we're optimistic right in this report is there are a lot of different methods that are likely to work well in different places. Like, for example, in Wisconsin, we could imagine doing more soil carbon sequestration with our agricultural lands. In other places, we could be doing direct air capture. In other places, doing more tree planting. And so there's a variety of solutions, which I think makes me optimistic, because any of them are going to have issues when you do them at really large scale, and you can mitigate some of those issues by having, you know, a bunch of solutions, not just one silver bullet.
I wonder if I'm going to, you know, build a wind turbine, I can hopefully sell that energy, make some money doing it. If I build an electric vehicle, I can sell it to somebody. Is there a market incentive we can have for carbon sequestration? Like, if I catch a bunch of carbon, who's going to pay me to do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's probably one of the biggest issues of all, is where is this market going to come from? But somewhat surprisingly, and this is one thing that, you know, I enjoy doing this science and reports when I learn something, and I learned in putting all the data together that we've had $200 million of purchases of removed carbon over the last year. And so, you know, that's substantial numbers. It's, you know, probably going to need to scale up to a couple more orders of magnitude, like by a factor of 100, to make this climate relevant. But that's a start. So there are people, companies, individuals, companies and countries that are actually starting to pay for removing CO2. But ultimately, we need to move beyond these kind of voluntary commitments of removal to policies that create strong incentives and obligations to remove CO2, because once we get to billions of tons a year, someone's going to have to be paying for that. And that's going to be a policy that will have to drive that.
Talking to Gregory Nemeth, co-author of the first State of Carbon Dioxide Removal Report, professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. We're talking about the role of CO2 removal in the effort to slow down climate change. It's not just cutting emissions, the report says, but getting some of that CO2 out of the atmosphere. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about these newer carbon dioxide removal technologies? Do you want to see the U.S., the federal government, invest more in these newer technologies? Would you like to see more tree planting? Is there a candidate piece of land in your neck of the woods that you think could be a good forest and draw some carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Gregory Nemeth, co-author of a new international report studying carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere. Gregory is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. We're looking at the world's current capacity, advancing technologies, future demand for taking CO2, carbon dioxide, out of the atmosphere in the effort to limit global warming. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the cost, the impact, the technologies when it comes to carbon dioxide removal? Do you want to see more research, development, public investment in carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Bring on a caller now. Doug is with us in Portage. Doug, hi.
Hi. I'm addressing the question that you just asked the guest about what's the incentives for someone to remove carbon dioxide from the air. And now I know, and to me the answer is biochar. If you take organic waste, leaves, grass, twigs, branches, bark, that things that removed carbon dioxide from the air within the last few years, and you pyrolyze it, some of the carbon gets put back into the air, but not all. About a third of it ends up creating charcoal. If you then put that charcoal into compost, you can sell that at a premium. People pay big bucks for biochar compost.
Interesting. And are you doing this yourself, Doug?
I am. Yes, I am. For my own good, I'm not selling it. I haven't. My goal is to make a backyard biochar that will emit no smoke, no odors, meet the 2.5 EPA regs for particulates, be able to run it on a host of different materials, not have to spend tons of time trying to get it perfect, to then be able to use the excess heat to do two things. One, I'm going to get granite dust from monument makers, gravestone makers. Uh-huh. They have no source for it. At the elevated moist temperature of the flue gas from burning wood, making biochar. It's not burning, pyrolyzing wood to make biochar and burning the syngas.
Uh-huh.
That granite dust will react, should react, quite rapidly with the carbon dioxide in the air, creating carbonates.
Wow.
And removing the carbon dioxide.
Doug, thanks a lot for sharing that backyard project. And that's in Doug's backyard, Gregory, but I understand biochar is on the menu of carbon dioxide capture technologies.
Yeah, great to hear from Doug. Certainly, biochar is one of the important arrows in our quiver. We assessed that we could do more than 1 billion tons a year from biochar. And as Doug suggests, it's interesting because there are what we call in innovation studies, niche markets. So there are places where people are willing to pay for biochar, and it's as an agricultural amendment, as he said, and the prices are actually quite high now. And we don't think that you can do 1 billion tons of biochar by selling it to people that are interested in, you know, flower beds in cities and things where you can have higher yields. Like that's one place that's used and it's highly valued. So you can't do 1 billion tons on that, but you can get started. And as Doug says, we're already getting started, and he's doing it for his own interest and maybe his own garden. Like he says, there's prices paid for biochar. So that's a great way to get started. And it has this benefit of creating higher agricultural yields while also storing carbon in the soils in the form of biochar, which is, you can kind of think of it as similar to charcoal that we make from wood. So yeah, certainly biochar is an interesting area and one that could move quickly because it's got these niche markets where you don't need a policy to get started. You can do what Doug's doing.
Doug, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. We heard from Barry in Janesville, who also mentions markets like welding gases and medical gases needing the carbon removed from the atmosphere. Interesting. Back to your calls now. Kelly is with us calling from Minnesota. Kelly, hi.
Kelly. Greetings. I would just like to remind your guest, who probably does not need reminding, but your listeners, that trees are not the only means of sequestering or direct air capture of carbon. Grass, although it's been forgotten by our federal ag policy for 75 years, has been direct capturing carbon for eons and can do so really more effectively than any Swiss or British Columbia direct air capture.
Interesting. Kelly, thanks a lot for sharing this with us. Grass, grasslands, Gregory, are they part of the toolkit here?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, there's scientists at UW-Madison that are working on that. And it's a lot about trying to appreciate what native plants and native grasses do so well, which is have super highly developed roots, which store a lot of carbon and material there and in the soils around them. So, yeah, grasses seems like something that's particularly interesting in our upper Midwest geography.
Kelly, thanks for that call. Jackie joins us now in Milwaukee. Jackie, hello.
I've got a place up north that can take some more trees. Are some tree species better than others?
Oh, interesting, Gregory. Do we have research saying if you're looking to capture carbon, plant tree X instead of tree Y?
Yeah, there are. I think the ones that have been worked on a fair amount in UW here are poplar trees. Because they grow fast. And so if you're growing fast, then you're storing a lot of carbon in the trunks of the trees. So yeah, that's certainly an interesting area. You know, one thing that we'll have to work out is if we try to optimize how much carbon we store in trees in one particular species, whichever one turns out to work most efficiently in a particular geography works out, we may still want to have some diversity in the forest, because we want to have biodiversity, we want to have healthy forests. And those depend not on monocultures, but on many different types of trees. So I think that's an interesting thing to think about. If you're going to plant a few trees, what's the optimal one for storing CO2 and storing carbon in the trees? But on a larger scale, we have to think about diversity too, because biodiversity is something that's also an objective and that does better when we have a variety of types of plants and trees.
Thanks a lot for that call. Gregory, I want to touch on a couple of other technologies that came up on the list. Here's one I don't really understand. Enhanced rock weathering.
Yeah, so that's something that, you know, some of these are nature directly observed, like planting trees, and some of them are nature inspired by looking at how rocks can actually react with CO2 that's in the atmosphere. It happens really slowly over time. We call it weathering. And one thing we could potentially do is do that on a much faster scale, and that's called enhanced weathering, where we react CO2 in the atmosphere with rocks. And the key there is just make a lot more surface area, because that's how you get reactions to happen. And so the key to making a lot of surface area with rocks is grinding them up into very fine particles. And that's something we know how to do in the mining industry. And so we would have to take, you know, minerals and grind them up into small particulates and then scatter them on agricultural fields or on coastlines. They become part of the ocean. And those are permanent removals because they stay, the CO2 would stay as carbon in the rocks that it reacts with. So there, it's not very, it's not rocket science. It's mining, but doing it on a large, really large scale. And anytime you do things on a really large industrial scale like that, there'll be issues. So again, it's another arrow in our quiver, but not something we would want to bank everything on because, you know, there's dust and particulates that come from crushing rocks that we would need to do there. So we'd have to be careful about how that works as well. None of these solutions are perfect and without their issues, but that's one that's appealing and attractive and in certain geographies could work really well.
And Gregory, you co-wrote this first of its kind report on carbon dioxide removal. Is this going to be a regular thing that you do now?
Yeah, we'd like it to be. You know, I think part of the reason is we could only do so much in the 100 or so pages that we had. And as we've talked about it to people and had people ask questions about it, we realized there's other things that we need to focus more on. So, for example, we're going to be doing more on looking into particular geographies. So this first report really wanted to scope everything comprehensively and globally, but it's going to be much more interesting on what's the potential, say, for biochar in the US or in the upper Midwest or in Wisconsin. So downscaling some of the analysis is one direction we go. Looking into some of the impacts, both positive and negative, of deploying these is something we've only sketched out that's going to be important as we go further. So that'll be something we'll look at as well. And then bringing in a broader set of perspectives than we had on this first round, I think will help elucidate some of the justice or distributional issues that might come with deploying some of these technologies that at the really large scale we'll need for them to be relevant for the climate.
And we'll leave it there. Gregory, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
That's Gregory Nemeth at UW-Madison's La Follette School, co-author of The State of Carbon Dioxide Removal Report.